Labor Day deals are looking good at Lowe's. Save $10 on 1 gallon cans and $50 on 5 gallon pails of select interior paint via rebate. Plus, get two 2.5 quart or 3 quart Mums for just $8. A fresh look and savings? Even better. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Mum sizes vary by location and exclude Alaska and Hawaii. See store at Lowe's.com for more details.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Midnight has passed, and in the stillness of these hours, the hauntings are never silent. This is Real Ghost Stories Online. After midnight.
She had seen a ghost once in her life. At least, that was what she had always believed happened. She was 10 years old, asleep in the bedroom she shared with her younger sister, when she woke in the middle of the night and saw a woman standing in the doorway. There was enough light from the hallway for her to see the shape clearly. The woman was older, wearing something pale, and stood with one hand resting against the doorframe. She didn't move or speak. She simply looked into the room for several seconds before disappearing. The next morning, her mother told her that a relative she had been close to had died during the night. Nothing like that ever happened again. As she got older, she occasionally wondered whether she had been fully awake or whether the timing had caused her childhood mind to turn an ordinary dream into something more important. Still, the memory never faded. And if someone asked whether she believed ghosts were possible, she usually said yes. She didn't expect anyone else to believe her, but she knew what she remembered. More than 30 years passed without another experience, which was why that night from her childhood never entered her mind when she received a jury summons. She had served on a jury once before, years earlier, for a minor civil case. This time was different. During jury selection, it became obvious that the case had received significant attention locally, and the judge warned potential jurors that the trial could last several weeks. It was a murder case. The victim was a woman in her early 30s, and the man accused of killing her had been someone she knew. The jurors were told not to read anything about the case, search for information online, or discuss it with anyone. Once the final jury was selected, the judge also announced that they would be sequestered during the trial. She had never imagined jury duty involving hotel rooms, deputies escorting them between the courthouse and hotel, and restrictions on what they could watch or read, but she understood why it was necessary. The case had received enough coverage that keeping outside information away from the jury mattered. During jury selection, she had been asked the question she expected. Did she know anyone involved? Had she or someone close to her been the victim of a violent crime? Did she have strong opinions about law enforcement? Could she presume the defendant innocent unless the prosecution proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt? She answered honestly. Nothing about seeing an apparition when she was 10 years old crossed her mind. Why would it? The trial began on a Monday morning, and the first few days were slower than she expected. There were opening statements, testimony establishing timelines and relationships, and long stretches involving records and details she had to work to follow. She quickly learned that being a juror was more exhausting than it looked. They were expected to sit quietly for hours, absorb an enormous amount of information, and remember enough of it to make sense later. They also couldn't discuss the case with one another, which made breaks feel strange. 12 people could spend an entire morning listening to disturbing testimony, then walk into the jury room and talk about lunch. The victim's photographs were shown early in the trial. One was an ordinary picture of her smiling at a family gathering. Another showed her at work. There were several others provided by relatives or taken from social media. The juror found herself studying them longer than she expected. Until then, the victim had mostly been a name. Hearing attorneys refer to the victim over and over created a distance from the person they were actually discussing. The photographs changed that. Suddenly, there was a face attached to the testimony. By Thursday evening, everyone on the jury looked tired. Their hotel was older but comfortable, and the jurors occupied several rooms with security nearby. They ate together but were constantly reminded not to discuss the trial. Most evenings, she read or watched harmless television until she was tired enough to sleep. That Thursday, testimony had focused heavily on the victim's final day. Witnesses described phone calls, errands, conversations, and small decisions that had seemed meaningless at the time but now mattered because investigators had built a timeline around them. She went to bed thinking about how strange that was. A person could go through an ordinary day without knowing that someday strangers might sit in a courtroom, analyzing every hour of it. She fell asleep quickly, then woke sometime during the night without knowing what had disturbed her. The room was dark except for a narrow strip of light coming through the curtains from the street below. The air conditioner was running, and she could hear traffic several floors beneath her. Then she noticed someone standing near the window. Her first thought was that another person was somehow inside the room. She pushed herself upright and reached toward the bedside lamp, but stopped before turning it on. The woman by the window wasn't moving. She stood several feet away, partly illuminated by the light through the curtains, looking directly at the bed. For a few seconds, the juror simply stared. Then the woman's face became familiar. She knew her, but not personally. She had been looking at that face all week. It was the woman whose murder they were hearing about in court. The victim didn't look injured. There was no blood, nothing frightening about her appearance. She looked much like she had in the ordinary photographs the jury had been shown. And if anything, that made it more unsettling. She was simply standing there, watching. The juror finally reached for the lamp. The instant the room filled with light, the woman was gone. She sat completely still for several minutes before getting out of bed and checking the room. The door was locked from the inside. The bathroom was empty. There was nowhere anyone could have gone. She tried to convince herself she had been dreaming. It was the obvious explanation. She had spent 4 days hearing testimony about this woman and looking at photographs of her, so of course her brain could have carried that into sleep. But lying there afterward, she found herself thinking about the experience she had when she was 10. She hadn't thought about it in years, and what bothered her was not that the two experiences looked exactly alike. It was the feeling. That strange certainty she had experienced as a child while looking toward her bedroom doorway and somehow knowing the woman standing there did not belong among the living. She had felt it again for the first time in more than 30 years, and now the person she believed she had seen was at the center of the murder trial she had been chosen to decide. She barely slept after that. Every time she started to drift off, she opened her eyes and looked toward the window again. Nothing else appeared, and by morning she had managed to convince herself that exhaustion and 4 days of testimony had probably done something strange to her mind. That explanation became easier once she was downstairs with the other jurors. Nobody seemed to notice anything unusual about her, and the routine of breakfast, security, and the drive back to the courthouse made the night before feel increasingly distant. Then she walked into the courtroom and saw the victim's photograph again. For a moment, she had the unsettling sensation that she was looking at someone she had actually met. She reminded herself that she hadn't. She had seen a woman standing in a dark hotel room for a few seconds, assuming she had even been awake. Whatever had happened, it had given her no information about the case. The woman hadn't spoken, pointed toward anything, or indicated whether the defendant was guilty. That mattered to her. She took the responsibility of being on the jury seriously, and the last thing she wanted was to allow something outside the courtroom to influence a decision that was supposed to be based entirely on evidence. She considered whether she should tell someone, but what exactly would she report? That she might have dreamed about the victim? Even if she believed it was more than that, nothing about the experience had told her anything the jury didn't already know. So she said nothing. What changed was the way she listened. Before that night, she had been paying attention because that was her job. Afterward, she became more aware of how easily the woman at the center of the case could disappear beneath all the details surrounding her death. Witnesses talked about phone records, text messages, and where vehicles had been seen. Detectives described evidence collected from different locations. Attorneys argued over timelines and questioned whether certain memories were reliable. Even people who had known the victim well were often asked to focus on very specific pieces of her life rather than who she had been as a whole. The juror understood why a murder trial had to work that way, but every time someone referred to her only as the victim, she pictured the woman standing beside the hotel window. It didn't make her more certain the defendant was guilty. If anything, it made her more cautious. If what she had seen really had been the woman whose death they were considering, then the worst possible response would be to let emotion decide the case. Justice for someone who had been murdered could not mean convicting the wrong person simply because everyone wanted an answer. That thought stayed with her through the following week. The prosecution presented evidence that sounded convincing at first, then the defense challenged parts of it. Some witnesses seemed certain until they were questioned more closely. Other pieces of evidence held up no matter how aggressively they were challenged. She began paying careful attention to which details came from testimony and which conclusions were being suggested by attorneys. The judge had repeatedly reminded them that arguments were not evidence, and she found herself returning to that instruction more often. A couple of times, she wondered whether she had become too invested because of what happened at the hotel. Then testimony would raise a legitimate question, and she realized she was still capable of considering it. She didn't want the defendant convicted because she had seen the victim. She wanted the jury to reach whatever verdict the evidence supported. The victim didn't appear again for several nights. By the middle of the second week, she had begun to wonder whether the experience really had been nothing more than an unusually vivid waking dream. The more time that passed, the easier it was to place it in the same uncertain category as the apparition from her childhood, something she remembered clearly but could never prove. Then came a difficult day of testimony. A medical examiner spent much of the afternoon explaining the victim's injuries and answering questions about how she had died. The testimony was clinical by necessity, but the juror found it harder to listen to than she expected. The woman from the smiling family photographs was reduced to injuries, measurements, and estimated times. By the time they returned to the hotel that evening, nobody talked much at dinner. She went to her room early, read for a while, and eventually turned off the light. She did not want to see the woman again, although the first appearance hadn't been frightening in the usual sense. The woman hadn't threatened her or tried to come closer. There was simply something deeply uncomfortable about being reminded that the person everyone had spent all day discussing as a body had once been alive. She fell asleep sometime after midnight. When she woke, the woman was there again, standing closer to the foot of the bed. This time the juror didn't reach for the lamp. She simply looked at her. The woman appeared exactly as she had before. No injuries, no blood, no expression of anger. She looked calm, almost ordinary, and for several seconds the two of them seemed to be watching each other in silence. Then the woman was gone. The juror remained awake long after the room was empty again, and this time she didn't spend much effort trying to convince herself it had been a dream. She also didn't believe the woman was asking her to find the defendant guilty. There had been nothing in either appearance that pointed toward him at all. What she felt instead was responsibility. Maybe the woman wanted nothing more than to be remembered as someone who had lived before strangers began discussing the details of her death. Maybe there was no message at all, and the juror was assigning meaning to something she couldn't explain. But one thought stayed with her through the rest of the night. Whatever verdict they eventually reached, they could not rush it. They could not decide because they were tired, because the trial had gone on too long, or because everyone wanted to go home. Sympathy for the victim could not replace proof, and reasonable questions could not be ignored simply because everyone wanted closure. They had to get it right. By the end of that week, both sides had nearly finished presenting their cases. The judge told the jury that closing arguments would begin soon, followed by instructions and deliberations. For the first time since the trial started, the decision no longer felt somewhere in the distance, and soon 12 people would go into a room and decide what they believed had happened. And one of them would enter that room carrying something the others knew nothing about. Closing arguments began the following Monday. By then, she had spent nearly 3 weeks listening to testimony, and she was surprised by how differently she heard the attorneys now. Both sides tried to pull the evidence into a clear story, but she kept reminding herself that the story itself wasn't evidence. She listened for what had actually been proven, what remained uncertain, and where either side might be asking the jury to make assumptions. The woman did not appear again. Part of her was relieved, while another part wondered whether that meant whatever had brought the victim to her hotel room had already accomplished what it needed to. She still didn't know whether there had been a message, but she knew what she had taken from it. Pay attention. Remember who this is about, and don't get it wrong. When the judge finally sent them to deliberate, the room felt different from every other space they had occupied together during the trial. For weeks they had been forbidden to discuss the case, and suddenly that was the only thing they were supposed to do. At first, everyone seemed eager to talk at once. Some jurors had clearly formed strong opinions before they entered the room, while others were less certain. They chose a foreperson, organized their notes, and began working through the evidence, and she quickly realized how easy it would have been to rush. They were tired, everyone wanted to go home, and they had been away from their families and normal routines for weeks. There was an understandable temptation to focus on the strongest pieces of evidence and move toward a verdict. She found herself slowing things down, not because she wanted to argue with anyone, and not because she believed she had some special understanding of the victim. She simply kept returning to details that mattered. When someone remembered testimony one way, she asked whether they were sure. When another juror dismissed a question raised by the defense, she wanted to know why. When the prosecution's strongest evidence came up, she asked them to separate what they knew from what they assumed. At one point, someone became frustrated and said they had already heard all of this for weeks. She understood the feeling, but hearing something and carefully deciding what it meant were two different things. They went back through testimony, requested clarification on a few points, and spent longer discussing certain evidence than she expected. There were disagreements, but they were not angry ones. Gradually, some of the uncertainty began to clear. She never mentioned the hotel room. There was no reason to. The woman had given her nothing that belonged in that deliberation room. She had provided no clue, no accusation, and no fact that could be weighed against the evidence. Whatever had happened belonged only to her. After many hours, the jury reached a unanimous verdict. She had expected to feel relief once it was over, but instead she felt the weight of the decision more strongly as they returned to the courtroom. The clerk read the verdict. Guilty. She watched the defendant's reaction, then looked toward the victim's family. There was no celebration. Some cried quietly, while others simply sat there, absorbing the end of something that had consumed years of their lives. For a moment, she found herself looking around the courtroom. She wasn't sure what she expected to see, but the victim wasn't there. Once the trial ended, the jurors were released from sequestration and allowed to go home. Returning to normal life felt surprisingly strange after weeks of being told where to go, what they could watch, and who they could speak to. The first night back in her own bed, she woke sometime after midnight and immediately looked toward the doorway. Nothing was there. The next night was the same, and then another. She never saw the woman again. For a while, she questioned whether she should have told the judge what had happened. She wondered whether simply seeing the victim had affected her more than she realized. But when she thought back over the deliberations, she knew she had not pushed for conviction because of the apparition. If anything, she had been more willing to question the prosecution because she had been so determined not to confuse sympathy with proof. Years later, many of the details of the trial began to fade. She forgot the names of some witnesses and could no longer remember exactly which day certain testimony had been given. Even parts of the evidence that had once occupied hours of discussion became difficult to recall. She never forgot the victim, not the photographs shown in court or the clinical descriptions of how she died, but the woman standing silently beside the hotel window. She still couldn't say with certainty why she appeared. Maybe it had been stress, exhaustion, and a mind overwhelmed by weeks of hearing about someone else's death. Maybe the experience when she was 10 had made her more willing to believe there could be another explanation. Or maybe, for reasons she would never understand, the woman had found a way to remind one juror that there was a person beneath all the evidence. She had never told her who to convict. She had only stood there, and perhaps that had been enough. Because from that night forward, the juror never again thought of the case as something she simply had to get through. She thought of it as something she had to get right.
Want more real ghost stories? Then press subscribe now so you don't miss any of the multiple new ghost stories we drop for you every day. Only here at Real Ghost Stories Online.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.